The Athletic.
Hello, TIFO listeners. I'm Ian McIntosh, host of the Football Manager Show by The Athletic. What do you mean you've never heard of it? Oh, you should give it a go. It's scientifically proven to make you better at Football Manager. Don't quote me on the science bit. Anyway, if you have heard of it and you're missing it, I've got good news. On May the 25th, we'll be putting on a Football Manager Masterclass. It's a sort of super pod, if you will. Tom Davidson from Sports Interactive will be in the studio with the ultimate guide to getting better at this bastard child of Skynet that masquerades as a video game. We've got Alex McLeish in the studio as well. He's going to teach real-life lessons that can help you in the game. And remember, this man played for Alex Ferguson and went on to win a major trophy with Birmingham City. And by the way, if you're under the impression that Alex is a dour, moody Scotsman, you could not be more wrong. He was our first ever guest on the Totally Football League show, and he's absolutely lovely. Kind of want him to be my real-life football friend, but let's keep that to ourselves. Don't want to scare him off. Anyway, I'm babbling away. Haven't told you the best bit. The best bit is that one ticket holder will win the chance to play Alex McLeish in a live-streamed game of Football Manager 2021 for actual prizes. Actual prizes. What's the prize? Only a bloody Nintendo Switch. What do you get if you lose? Nothing. Because this is like Football Manager Gladiators with fewer lions. Anyway, we've got loads of other prizes, books, all sorts. So, if you want to come along, it's £7. £7, that's the price of a pint if you go to the wrong pub in London. £7, and you can get that ticket by visiting link.dice.fm/masterclass. That's link.dice.fm/masterclass. I'll see you there.
Welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. Me again, sorry. I did speak to Joe this morning, but he came back from holiday very late last night, missed all the football, and there's also some very, very loud drilling happening outside the office in his new house, and he is not happy about it and in no fit state to record. It's me and JJ again. Hello, JJ.
Hello. It's me.
It is you.
Yes.
What did you and I talk about today?
We talked about loads of stuff. We talked about Leicester, Kasper Schmeichel's punching ability and how it relates to video games. We talked about Chelsea a little bit. We talked about Frank Lampard, not related to Chelsea, but what on earth he's going to do next. We did a lot of talk about how you change culture within a club.
That was very interesting, that bit. I thought that was cool.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you liked that because it was mostly me talking. And then we did a bit in Scotland, and Callum Davidson, who you may have seen slide. Well, we talked about that, actually. And then we talked about Forest for a little bit. I was thinking about the Forest. And I think I did some of my cliches again.
I'll tell you what, that recap, it's a high-pressure moment in the podcast. Like when someone says, oh, what did we talk about today? And all of a sudden, oh, I just can't remember. And like you're on the spot and you're trying to think of how we spent the last hour. Like I always panic when Joe does that. So I was kind of just inflicting on you. And unfortunately, you did very well with it. That was
Thanks, because I always have the notes open.
You do indeed. Okay, so by the time this comes out, we will be in England squad announcement territory. And if you want to read about all the goings on there and the controversies and the disappointments and all that kind of stuff, get yourself along to The Athletic, where there is a really good deal available for you. It's first month is free, and then £4.99 a month thereafter. And if you want to take advantage of that, go to theathletic.com/TIFO. That's theathletic.com/TIFO. We spent last week saying lots of very, very nice things about Kasper Schmeichel. So for balance and even out the universe, let's begin this podcast by slagging him off a little bit. JJ, his own goal against Tottenham reminded you of what?
Whenever I die in Call of Duty Warzone, and it is my fault, but I blame lag, my teammates, anything else. The game is jipping me, essentially what he's doing. He clearly punched that into his own net and then turns to look at everyone else like,
Also, there's no foul. There's just no foul. There's no...
Absolutely.
I feel like it's almost a goalkeeping specialty, though, isn't it? It's because, like, in the first instance, you have to react very, very quickly, and you have to be very loud and look very angry and make a lot of gestures with your hands. And then whilst you're doing that, you've got a kind of multitask, a rationalisation of what's happened. It's difficult.
It's so complicated. Like, have you got to punch that ball knowing there's loads of massive dudes in the same box as you who are really physically strong?
Yeah.
And some of them are going to be trying to block you as well. And you've got to pay attention to that. Work out if someone's next to you. You can't even be 100% sure it's the right option you're taking every single time. But you can't just flap at it. Although that would have been the best option there. But yeah, it's easier to... do it in hindsight. What a shame that happens in this last game of the season. And the weird thing about this is that you say, oh, well, they spursed it in the very last part of the season. But really, you'd say it's the, you know, dropping points against Newcastle is what's ended their Champions League hopes early. It's a shame that it feels a bit down now after winning the FA Cup as well. But you can't blame Schmeichel for all that. You know, these things happen.
I felt as if... No, you can't blame Schmeichel for all that. And I thought Tottenham played quite well. More importantly, though, it seemed like from about 70 minutes on, as if Leicester were just knackered. Absolutely knackered. And there was just... They never really seemed like they were going to score again. I want to talk a little bit about the second Jamie Vardy incident, because I saw it live and got quite angry about it in a sort of detached... I hate the PGMOL and the referee... and Mike Riley and VAR in that kind of way. And I looked at it again just before I went to bed, just after I finished doing our pod notes. And for those who haven't seen it, so Jamie Vardy runs across Davinson Sanchez. Davinson Sanchez is running in a straight line, doesn't alter his position or his arms in any way when Vardy comes across him. Vardy kind of sticks his hand in between his shoulder and his arm, like you would, you know, poke a stick between the spokes of a bike, like that. And then Jamie Vardy kind of throws himself over. And it's like, if that had happened in professional wrestling, you'd be like, that's just great. That's just wonderful timing. Well done. Excellent choreography. Fantastic. And also, if this was a pre-VAR era, you'd say, yeah, I can understand why a referee gave a penalty for that. To go over to this, how does that get given?
I
talk me down, JJ, because that is I still don't understand this.
He's so devious. He is the most weaselly of all the strikers. Jamie Vardy has done it. I mean, for seasons now, what he does is runs across the defender and throws his legs out so they catch him to bring him down.
Yeah,
that's a really great trick. But this one here, yeah, so that exactly as you described, it's a little bit like those videos on YouTube when like a skateboarder crashes onto a car to let them take it fast and then they jump off and go really quick.
Yeah.
Basically what he's doing, I don't see how we could do it either. I don't think the first one's even a penalty. I don't think that contact takes him down. Yeah, I don't think that takes him down. I think he feels it and goes down. There's a few examples of this weekend. I think Richarlison was at it. In the Everton game, there's just a few things, a few examples of players just going down. In fact, Traore at Aston Villa went down really easily, but it's that classic example of you don't go down, you don't get the foul, but it's also because it's not a foul.
I think what perplexes me though is like you're right, Vardy has a habit of this. He's kind of this generation's Andy Johnson. Do you remember the amount of penalties he used to win at Palace and then later at Everton? Like he has his little tactics and he has his ways of manufacturing contact and or penalties. But if you're a referee, like we actually did a video about this on the TIFO channel, and we hear about the extensive reviews and, you know, how referees are graded. Like if you're a referee and you've given a penalty for one of these incidents, you're sitting in your review room on a Monday, and you know your assessor's saying, well, you know, that's a bit shit because look what he's doing there, and you'd be like, oh yeah, okay, sorry, yeah, my bad. And then maybe a few weeks later, you know, the next time you referee the same player, it happens again, the assessor might say to you, well, did you not remember what we talked about? You know, are you not watching out for this stuff? When it happens over many, many years, what's the excuse? Like, what's the excuse for not giving it necessarily, because you can't always say, well, that's not a penalty because, you know, this player goes to ground easily, therefore he is never fouled. I'm not suggesting that. But how do you not go over to the screen and think, oh yeah, I can see that? Because everybody in the country saw the replay and saw what happened. It just, it's illogical in a way that really troubles me. More than the result, more than conceding the goal or the penalty. It's like it's the flaw in the thinking, which I find really difficult to accept.
I know what you mean. It's kind of... It's like if they're deciding the rules, but it doesn't reflect what everyone who plays football would... Because you know, like if you're running and playing football and you get a little leg at you, it doesn't make you fall over. So you know when it's someone's trying to buy the foul. But then these referees are either going with a law that says, well, we have to determine what contact is, no matter if it's going to... Like, they don't have to bring in like Newton's law or anything like that and try and really ascertain whether this certain part of the shin is enough to make you fall down. But then that's how they're deciding it, because there is contact there and then he's gone down. That must be what qualifies. Is that it's the same thing almost as handball. And it's why, like I said before, I think VAR could be good. But the modern application of laws that require split-second opinion-based decision is odd, because now you're looking at VAR and it must be that he's given the foul based on technically what it should be. That is that you know what I mean? It's not like maybe he doesn't even think it is, but technically it has to be, so he has to go with it.
Ugh. But this is the thing. This is the problem, though, isn't it? Because like we should not probably be having this conversation on Monday. Like it shouldn't be that complicated. Let's move on. My brain can't process this because it's too stupid. It's just anyway, right. So Chelsea, Leicester, Liverpool have a big old kerfuffle for the Champions League spots. Chelsea and Liverpool get over the line. Chelsea a little bit lucky though, because they were bad at Villa Park. And post the event, they also came up with one of the crappiest, weakest excuses for being bad I've ever seen, which was reported breathlessly by the Daily Mail that on entering Villa Park, they were actually held up for 15 minutes because stewards who might have been clearing them a parking space were actually caught eating ice cream in capital letters. Can you better that as a kind of justification for defeat, JJ? There must be something in Scotland that's worse than that.
Oh, almost certainly. There'll be loads. It gets quite petty, but that's part of what makes Scottish football really entertaining, is that's the sort of thing that you just kind of get used to. Very odd that Chelsea then do it. Seems a bit... Yeah. I don't know how... not to doubt the authenticity of that particular piece, but sometimes I wonder of certain stories that appear in said story and whether they have been slightly sensationalised. However, yeah, Chelsea kind of lucky. And I think... I don't know, it felt like... Certainly as a neutral, I wanted Leicester to do it because they've been there for so long and it's just nice to have a bit of change. You know, I think that's kind of...
Yeah.
There's something about them that reminds me a little bit of like the old Newcastle teams or something like that. You want them to do well. But Chelsea get it done even though they lose? I wonder... This is the sort of thing I'm thinking about Tuchel's Chelsea, is that I wonder how much of his style of play really, really relies on intensity and... constant momentum and players always having this big drive to play as like hard and fast and perfect as they possibly can each time. And if they drop the levels, you can beat them. It's sort of almost a bit like, I suppose Jurgen Klopp's a good example. Like if they're not playing at the right intensity, it just doesn't work. And you see it with Chelsea when they're slow and predictable.
Do you mean in the sense that if you drop the intensity, it's all of a sudden the flaws kind of start to reveal themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. And as soon as teams can get at them, because I mean, a lot of the games have been quite boring to watch. They've been really exciting the last few weeks. And I think the performance against Leicester in the league after the FA Cup was, we spoke about this last week. I thought they were brilliant. But then that's followed up with this now against Aston Villa.
This is weird, because we talked about this a couple of days ago, which was they seemed to, according to Antonio Rudiger, they motivated themselves on the back of Daniel Amati's shocking disrespect in the Wembley changing room, and that was kind of this fire that lit the Chelsea boiler. Yet Champions League place on the line, phone it in, lads. Just don't worry about it too much.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm not quite done with this ice cream thing, because something occurred to me. Like, I just thought, you're on the coach and you're outside Villa Park, which has a sort of a very big kind of parking area and a very beautiful ground, Villa Park, if people haven't had the chance to go. But you're there and you're on the coach and you've got an important Premier League game and you want to get to your parking space, but it isn't being cleared, and you've spotted stewards eating ice cream. Like, surely the thing you do before phoning the Daily Mail to complain about it is to just say, can you put down the ice cream and help us quickly? Or did was there as kind of a Chelsea envoy who was sent to do that, and was he just told to fuck off? I need to know a little bit more about the process. This doesn't another kind of Vardy penalty conundrum. It doesn't make sense.
Like, maybe it's similar to how I have used my analogy of dying at Warzone and blaming people who aren't myself. Perhaps Thomas Tuchel or whoever's at Chelsea's done this is doing the same sort of thing, where even though they've lost and it's their own fault, it's got to be the lag. Basically, they were gypped. Didn't go the way they thought it would, and so they have to find some excuses.
They're sitting, you know, on the coach on the way back, and Cesar Azpilicueta is kind of moaning about something like that, and that's the kind of reason why. Yeah, maybe.
It might be classic deflection as well, like the kind of thing that Sir Alex would do back in the day.
I feel like it needs to step up a few levels. I think there needs to be a bit more conspiracy in it. I think they're also the problem with this is that faceless stewards eating ice cream, they're quite innocent as a target. Like it's a you know, summer's day, basically end of the season, ice cream, fine. I don't have that much of a problem with it. Like if they were delayed because someone spotted them interfering with the coach's petrol tank, I feel like that's more Mourinho-ish, maybe. Like, I think you need to try harder if you want to, you know, construct a proper grievance.
I like the idea that it's turning into wacky races where someone's cutting the brakes or something like that. I'm not sure if that's going to happen. But
hello, I'm Mark Chapman, and I'm here to tell you what The Athletic has planned across its podcast network during the Euros. My pod with David Ornstein will become The Athletic's England show throughout the tournament to bring you all the latest news and insight from inside the England camp every single day. Then we'll also have nightly editions of the Totally Football show, taking a look at all the big talking points from the competition and looking ahead to the next day's fixtures. Now, if you're feeling nostalgic for tournaments past, we've produced an 8-part documentary series that tells some fascinating stories from both on and off the pitch from the last 8 Euros. Elsewhere, Michael Cox's Zonal Marking Pod will offer an in-depth tactical breakdown of all the biggest games, while Adam Hurry's Football Cliché Show will take a look at the tournament's alternative storylines. So, as this never-ending domestic season finally draws to a close, we'll have plenty of Euro 2020 coverage for you to enjoy as the tournament gets underway in just a couple of weeks' time.
No conspiracy at Man City. They absolutely battered Everton. Let's start with Everton, because I'm really disappointed with Everton. Mm. Like I tweeted this out a couple of days ago. I just think there are too many good players for them to be not this bad, but this bad in this way so often. Does that make sense?
Yeah. On a similar note, I think the same thing you're saying for me is that they're just really medium.
Yeah.
They don't have, like, they've got all, if they were in FIFA, all the players are rated like 81. There's no like 87s, do you know? And you need those to be able to get to the next level. I don't know. I often think about this because clearly Carlo Ancelotti is one of the greatest managers probably of all time for the things he's achieved. So you can't possibly think you need to change him.
No.
Surely. But then what have you got? So you can look for the team. Like Jordan Pickford, really medium, I think. Ben Goffrey, all right. Michael Keane
will be a good player, not quite more than average at the moment. Ben Goffrey,
exactly. He's never going to he's never going to be changed the world. Lucadinha, fine, but didn't cut it at the top teams. Mason Holgate, not for me.
Fine.
Yeah, Doucouré, really good, but also
I like Doucouré.
Yeah, I like him too, but also sometimes he's. This is the thing. Like sometimes he's great and he does everything. Like what a midfielder! That's who Man United should be saying. That's the kind of player that they should have. And then he does nothing. Allen, I really like a lot. Gylfi Sigurdsson's quite a good example of it. Doesn't quite do the hard work that you need. And maybe remember going back to the mentality of teams as we're talking about the other podcast, is that they don't have enough players who want to.
Don't want enough. Just full of players that just don't care enough. Is that your analysis?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, this is it changes systems so often, and that's not a bad thing because you have to try and find out what your best team is, but it might even be as basic as they lack pace. That might be what they don't have. Richarlison's quick, but I'd say he's better at driving through the middle rather than out wide. And so they're relying a lot. They played, it's like a diamond they played in this game. I mean, I think this is a bit of an anomaly because the City were always going to destroy them regardless of what happened. But yeah, I can't blame Ancelotti for anything. And also, I love Ancelotti. But there's something about that Everton team that's very beatable. I don't think there's any fear of playing Everton whatsoever.
I think more so than any other team I've watched in England over the last sort of 10 years, like Everton, when I see a certain type of Everton fixture on the fixture list, I know exactly what it's going to look like. It's a home game. It's against someone a bit rubbish. Obviously, this doesn't really relate to the Man City result, but it's against, you know, someone a bit rubbish, someone they should win, probably someone they should beat maybe 2 or 3 nil. And it's going to involve like a little bit of a scrappy goal for the away team in the first half. And then like about an hour's worth of turgid football in which the ideas gradually drain away. The fans get really, really, really hacked off. And there's kind of this acceptance that it won't ever inform any sort of improvement. It's really weird. And I feel like that's a cross-era thing. Like that's, I saw that with obviously Marco Silva, Roberto Martinez had a few games like that. I really antagonized that fan base. I'm with you. Like I have to believe the problem is not with Carlo Ancelotti. Like, I'm always going to side with the European Cup winner. Yes, it's Jose Mourinho.
It's the culture of the club, though, right? That's what that needs to change. But how, I mean, it's the culture of Everton's embedded forever. They never get relegated, they never will, but they're never going to win anything. And it just takes a really special manager, group of players to change all that. They have the manager, they have a good team, but yet the culture is still just, this will do, like, that's good enough. I don't know.
I wonder how you actually change culture, because I agree with you. I think there's a sort of, I think it's at certain clubs, and I include Tottenham in this, I think they're still kind of there. It's kind of okay to fail. Like it's okay because you're only little old Tottenham, little old Everton. It doesn't really matter. No one expects us to beat Man City. So it's okay just to be pumped 5-0 by them. It's that, isn't it? How do you change that beyond... Well, I don't know. Are you changing portraits and pictures on the walls? Are you, you know, like you painting the dressing room orange? I know what it means, but I don't know any of the detail that it involves, really.
I mean, I am fascinated by this as well. And I did a lot of reading and talking to managers in my time at the Telegraph. And I think there's good examples just from Scotland this season. So anyone, I mean, I'm sure not everyone that listens to this podcast ever watches Scottish football, but Rangers went from, there's a whole long story with them, but basically Steven Gerrard took them over and has managed to turn them into a team which has gone unbeaten. And it looked like they just couldn't touch Celtic because they were so far ahead. And he's done that by a similar way to what I think happened at Aberdeen, who a team who were hugely successful in the 80s, did well in the 90s even. Sir Alex Ferguson was their manager in the 80s. And did well in the 90s, and then had a little success period in the early 2000s, and then just didn't do anything for years, always finishing like lower mid table, just nothing. And Derek McInnes is a guy who came in, and what he did was set like professional standards in the club. I don't know how you, even things like the website improved. Like genuinely, this stuff is all. Like, Aberdeen looks quite a professional looking club now. It wasn't all McInnes. It's a lot to the new chairman and stuff like that, to be specific. But these sorts of things came in. And then on the playing staff, rather than buying like a good defensive midfielder and a really pacey winger who's very skillful, he'll do the job, he signed captains. So he signed like the captains from like Hamilton and Inverness Caledonian Thistle. Not even amazing clubs, but the ones who are the leaders, who are desperate to win, and you put 3, 4, or 5 of those in the same dressing room, and that's like you breed the culture. And it's not the manager who drives the players on, it's each the players themselves that do it. And you look even at like that Michael Jordan documentary,
Yeah.
Well, the Red Bulls. Is the Red Bulls? Oh, my God. The Chicago Bulls. Come on now. Monday.
Hey, man. You know, the sporting world is always shifting. Those plates are always moving. You never know. Like Red Bull, maybe.
Michael Jordan and Red Bull. It sounds like a thing that could happen. He's a... Yeah, that documentary that I can't remember the name of, whatever it was brilliant. But that's the sort of thing. You need
Last
those...
Dance.
Last Dance. God, it was good, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's great. Great.
Just putting in those characters, the leaders, who want it more... And then you put them in a framework where the manager knows the stuff, builds a system around the players, or introduces a system that he has time to build players to. I mean, the culture of a club is ingrained in a lot of them because it's more than just the current team. It's all the staff who are there. It's the way, like, what you measure to be success and what you're happy to put up with. And I think, I see it in Rangers that culture shift. They've gone from being one of the most successful clubs of all time and then being liquidated. And this version of Rangers, it's still Rangers, technically. That's a whole can of worms I shouldn't possibly go near. Rangers now have gone from being it's quite funny. There's a thing called referred to the banter years. There's loads of really funny things that should never have happened. The manager got fired after having an argument with some fans outside while he was standing in a bush. Just weird stuff.
God,
that was funny as well.
Excruciating. Yeah.
And now they're unbeaten. And that is a culture shift that has taken Steven Gerrard to recruit very wisely by buying wise players like Stephen Davis, not the best player, but so important to that kind of team. I can't name any players off my head that's really done that, but just more of them they put in and it's changed it. And that's, I mean, probably what Ancelotti has to do is change the culture of a club. But how do you do it at this near Super League billionaire playground? It's possible because the players that get you that level are either not good enough technically or they're too expensive. Like Ruben Dias is not the most technically gifted player by any means, but he is immensely important to how Manchester City play, for example.
I wonder if things like, because that's an interesting point about how you change things in this era. I wonder if things like new stadiums matter, because obviously that's on Everton's horizon. Mm-hmm. Always think about there was an anecdote about when Scott Sinclair joined Swansea, Swansea City. And I think he would, I don't know whether he was coming directly from there, but he'd obviously kind of grown up in the Chelsea system or had been playing there. And he got to, I think, the Swansea City training ground. And back then it was in pretty poor condition. And I think it was underwater that day or whatever. And he was just like, I don't want to be here. I'll tear up the contract, set fire to it. I'm going to go. And he ended up going there and being very successful. And I wonder whether there's something to that environment, because you hear both sides of this. You hear, oh, it's a bit nice for them. Life's a bit comfortable. You know, that those sleeping pods in that, you know, brand new training center, bit nice, bit too good for players that haven't really achieved anything. Or you hear the other version of it, which is kind of, well, you know, if you're asking your first team to get changed in a porter cabin, and fetch footballs from bushes or, you know, forests, then probably that's not inducive to a particularly impressive level of performance.
Who's training in a forest? Like,
hey,
that?
But no, honestly, have you seen, I think it was last season or maybe the year before, Borussia Dortmund went to a training camp in Austria, and it was in the middle of the forest. It just looked like paradise. You know, it was all sort of drizzly and cool and fresh, and it was right in the middle of a forest. There were just big, tall trees, you know, surrounding the pitch, and it was all secluded and great, and it just looked perfect. So it must happen. There are forests around, like in Europe and in parts of England and Scotland, probably. But it's like these are very woolly things. Like, it's kind of like, oh, you know, fix the training ground, and you know, then we'll be able to beat West Brom at home. Like, it's just, when you hear yourself say something like that, it doesn't sound very, very compelling or convincing.
I think I saw that at Newcastle, because they've not really updated their training ground in years. They have those ice baths, like the cryogenic chamber is a wheelie bin. Callum Wilson, welcome to the chamber. This looks an awful lot like a bin.
Cubes.
Yeah, Steve, this looks like a bin. No. This is the chamber.
It's cutting edge technology.
It's got an LED light on it. That's from the spokes of a bicycle. Get in the chamber.
Got a different colour limb, you know, like a nice little sort of nice little lid on it. It's red, you know. It looks impressive. It's interesting.
Yeah.
You spent a bit of your weekend telling me how important it was for us to talk about Callum Davidson. Now,
listeners may know Callum Davidson from a video that's going around which shows him diving and sliding through his dressing room headfirst and hitting his head on a door. JJ, talk to me about Callum Davidson.
Callum Davidson, who is sadly now dead after slamming his head into that door. People are trying to, I don't want to patronise anyone who knows an awful lot about Scottish football, but St Johnstone aren't very good at the old football. They're traditionally a team who would be battling against relegation, or the best they're going to really hope for is mid-table. And if they have a nice little run in the cups, that's good. They won the Scottish Cup a little while ago, and that was a lovely day. Like, it was, there's books written about it. Our Day in May, I think it was called, is the book written about it. Huge day for everyone. St Johnstone are from Perth, which is not a hugely exciting city either.
Are they the club who play on the ground with which has the double-decker bus behind one of the goals?
It's a few of those.
No, it always comes up on, like, you know, on goal compilations. There's that one Scottish ground where, you know, no one's really worked out what to do with the end of the ground. So there's like a double-decker bus part there, which has got a bit of advertising on it. Which one is that? Is a few goals?
I think that's Hamilton. Hamilton, okay, basically, okay. Like half the ground open. There's one you can see, like, a Morrison's in the background. It's so, so shit.
What the fuck, it's very Oxford United. Oxford United. Oxford, when Oxford United left the Manor Ground and relocated to the Kazam Stadium, the guy who owned the club at the time, Feroz Kassam, only built three sides to the stadium because he wasn't convinced that there was enough local interest to justify a fourth stand. So at one end, there's just a fence, just a wooden fence at the end, car park and a bowling arena.
Good. But, like, at lower leagues, it's quite funny. But when you've got, like, Sky Sports cameras there and the commentators referencing elite level football and Steven Gerrard's new reign, and then there's two lads sitting next to a bus, one's on a ladder, watching over
sausage roll,
Oh, it makes it magical. And that's part of the reason that makes Callum Davidson just a wonderful person to talk about just now, because he's gone from being, he was a footballer decent in his day, and he's left back for Scotland.
Blackburn,
yeah, he did. And he was assistant at St Johnstone to Tommy Wright, who then left because he'd basically hit the glass ceiling with St Johnstone. They were never going to get above finishing seventh or anything like that. They just couldn't do it. There's a split in Scotland, so it splits into two halves of the table. And that was kind of what happened to St Johnstone, and Davidson took over. No one knew what to expect. Didn't start very well. I don't have the numbers on top of my head, but they didn't win very many games, like the first 10 or 15. And then all of a sudden something clicked, and they've ended up winning a cup double, and they're the only team outside of Aberdeen back in the glory days of, like, 80s and 90s, Celtic and Rangers, to have done that. And they're not even very good. And this thing, now everyone's going, like, Callum Davidson is manager of the year. He's won two cups. And I think that's an interesting discussion point, because I wonder how much of it is momentum and how much of it is he is an actual tactical genius. Because St Johnstone finished in the top six, huge achievement for them alone, and they won a cup double. They scored 36 goals in 38 games in the league, conceded 46. There's no... A couple of players have come on a lot. And their tactics are, they play a 3-5-2 or a 3-4-3 and have the overlapping centre-backs thing that was trending last year, that Sheffield United used to do, remember? And their assistant manager, it wasn't Chris Wilder that came up with that, it was Alan Nil. Don't know if you knew that. That was an interesting conversation I had with him. I learned about overlapping centre-backs from Alan Nil, who then didn't want to say anything about it. No, but yeah, it was me.
You know what, the thing is, a lot of the Sheffield United fans on Twitter are big Alan Nil fans. Like, anytime you, obviously Chris Wilder attracted a lot of praise last season, not so much this season, but last season. And anytime you wrote about that or mentioned it on a podcast, very cheerfully and friendly, in a friendly way, you get a fan saying, yeah, but it's Nil as well. His, like, that back three overlapping centre-back design is really interesting. The other thing, like, Alan Nil's set pieces are brilliant. Like, I know that's a bit of a nerdy thing to say, but if you have, like, if you have a subscription to a Y Scout or, you know, something similar, and you just watch a team's set pieces, you really get a feel for kind of some of the interesting things they do, like, you know, dragging a centre back this way or blocking someone, like a what's that thing in basketball when someone just gets in the way? What's that called?
Screen. Blocking.
Setting a screen, yeah. There's loads of little interesting things like that. So there's something for everybody in Alan Neil football. Sorry, JJ, carry on with your Callum Davison propaganda.
I know. So yeah, I don't know whether, I mean, because we talked about Steven Gerrard's culture change at Rangers, and I think him to have won the league unbeaten is, sure enough, they've got the most expensive squad and pay all the wages, right? They've got money to have helped. That's certainly helped them. But to do it well is difficult. And it's hugely impressive. But Davidson's won a double with a team of, like, Sean Rooney. This is weird as well. Sean Rooney is a right wing back who couldn't even get in the team until Millwall recalled their right wing back halfway through the season. So Rooney got in the team. He scored the winning goal in the Scottish League Cup final in the 32nd minute. And he scored the winning goal in the Scottish Cup in the 32nd minute.
Ooh.
Oh.
So, I don't know a more appropriate noise, like just ooh.
Okay. I don't really know what I hoped from you there. It was more than the ooh, but I think it was a cool stat. And yeah, it's interesting that Davidson's got that. And the thing is now, he'll be hyped up and there'll be clubs south of the border who start who start looking at Davidson and be like, what magic does he have? And he's probably, I don't want to slag him off because it's a phenomenal achievement. I don't know what I'm doing, really. Yeah.
I love the phrase south of the border, as if England's kind of this sunlit uplands of the British Isles. Like it's a kind of, where management dreams come true. It's so patronising and like,
yeah.
I don't know. It's if I was Scottish, I think I'd hate it. Absolutely hate it. Interesting. I was doing our pod plan last night and I remember thinking, I know what I'm going to ask JJ because, why not? Who's your favourite Scottish player of all time?
Oh, that's a really good question.
I thought we'd like start to drum up the Anglo-Scottish rivalry ahead of the Euros.
Favourite Scottish player? I mean, I'd probably... it's more of an Aberdeen player. I love watching Ian Jess, but I think that's more just sort of local club bias. For actual Scotland, I mean, Colin Hendry was so cool having him in the team. He was great. James McFadden... Loved him. I'm not old enough to have watched Kenny Dalglish or Dennis Law or anything like that, so I don't know who the actual good players are. It's like I'm very much not old enough to have seen those, just to be clear.
I actually have an in-Jess anecdote. It involves me admitting to having read Barry Fry's autobiography, unfortunately. But alas, I did that at school. And apparently, when Barry Fry was at Birmingham City, he took a forward on trial, and there was like a... I'm going to give this up because I can't remember exactly the details of it. It's going to be rambling and shit. But it involved Ian Jess kicking a very highly rated Football League centre forward up in the air lots and lots and lots of times in trial match and something happening after that. I mean, it's not a classic anecdote, is it?
I don't really know but what the anecdote is.
No. I'll be honest. No,
but I like it. Let's keep going.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is that in a way, like my rambling recollection of that kind of, kind of flatters me because it means that clearly I did not read Barry Fry's autobiography anytime recently. So it's been a long time and that works in my defence. And we shall move on from that, I think.
Available on Amazon now.
Yeah, there are good bits in it, I think. There's a really good bit about a really good chapter about a character called Stan Flashman, who, if you know who that is, that will bring a smile to your face. If you don't, find out, because he's kind of like one of those roguish characters from the depths of non-league football from a different era. It's very, very funny.
This is a real person, because it very much sounds like a cartoon that has come to life or something.
Yeah, he's like that kind of ripped male from Blackadder, but just like a distant relative.
Oh, man. Love it.
Yeah, he's not Captain Flashart, but he is Stan Flashman. Yeah, find out about him. He was a ticket tout who owned Barnet, and yeah, it was just... quite a funny character. One of the notes you've left here in the plan is, what next for Crystal Palace? Why would Frank Lampard go to West Brom or Palace? Don't care as much about West Brom today because we will handle that in another episode. Palace is a strange one because Roy Hodgson has left. He has called time on his tenure at Palace. And the last time Palace tried to make a kind of progressive move with a coaching appointment, didn't go so well. Terrifically well with Frank de Boer. What is next for them? And like, also, JJ, I don't really know what Frank Lampard is as a coach. Like, I can't make a case for him going anywhere because I still don't Do you see what I'm getting at? He's just...
I would absolutely understand. I don't think he did amazingly well at Derby, although it seems to have gone better than it has for since he's left. I think at Chelsea... Like, it's really hard to be critical of Lampard having never seen his coaching sessions or never been in the dressing room and knowing what he wants to do. But it looked like he wanted to play quick football, get the ball from back to front really, really quickly. And I think I've heard him say that. He likes to be in the front foot. I think lazily we can assume he'd want to play a bit like Mourinho did with the 4-2-3-1 and trying to be compact, but also, I was going to say razzle dazzle. And I'm going to stick with it. Razzle dazzle the opposition. What the hell's going on here? A weird thing Chelsea did when he had them was if they had, say, their front four of the 4-2-3-1, they'd have three or four players on the left side of the pitch of the attack, and they'd focus play all there, and they'd have one turn up randomly kind of spaced out. So of a front three, you'd have the one, the two, and the striker would be sort of equally spaced, say 5 metres apart, and then you'd have the third, what the hell am I talking about?
Slightly isn't further your best away. Segment, JJ.
Like, no. It's a long weekend. And he's so further away. He had some tactics that didn't really make much sense. And you saw them get opened up time and time again in the counter. There was no real control, I thought, of games. And I think you need to have some of that. Callum Davidson has control. You put him in charge of Crystal Palace and they will finish 12th every year, baby. So maybe that's what you want. But Lampard, I think worse than Palace putting him in, it's more for what Lampard's going to do. Because he's not really won anything or proven that he can do any more than sort of reaching that sort of limit of where Derby and Chelsea got. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because also, there are so many caveats. The Derby team did quite well and they had that very impressive win against Leeds in the playoff semi-final. Although that felt a lot more about Leeds than it did about them, and it depended on Mason Mount, and then in the final they were absolutely atrocious against Villa. Really disappointing. And then Chelsea, there are impressive moments to Lampard's reign at Chelsea, but then there are just as many really ugly results and performances, and it becomes a zero-sum game. So what you're left with is just a very neutral perspective on Frank Lampard. It's very, very hard to judge him for, and also because, let's be fair, he had such a wonderful playing career and achieved so much that it's very, very difficult to step out of that shadow.
But if he now goes to a club like Palace or someone who you're never really going to win anything with, I think it probably is a big detriment to his upwards career path he wants to take, where he'd want to manage the likes of Chelsea again. So you can't really go up again. And the only real option, I think, from having... that all this sort of stuff fascinates me. How come certain managers get big jobs and win trophies when... Marco Silva's won trophies, is he that good? I don't know. Lampard, he needs to go probably abroad or even to somewhere like Celtic if they would take him, because he can win trophies. And once you've proven you can win trophies, when you've got the platform to do it, say like Olympiacos or something like that, So you can choose, prove you've got the talent to turn a team into someone that wins stuff. Because certain managers go in and they don't, we'll surely talk about it. Pirlo at Juventus, is he a good manager? Maybe you can tell me. But, they fell off dramatically. Is it because they're not a good enough manager? Is it too much of a culture shift when you put them in at a certain time? Do they need to go somewhere else to learn how to make mistakes first before you go in? A lot of these good managers took on the reserves and made all their mistakes first.
Yeah, I like the taking the reserves first approach. I wonder whether... if you have a job at somewhere like Chelsea really early in your career before people think you're ready, there's that excuse when things go wrong, be like, yeah, well, it might come around again. I think that's a little bit of a false economy, because I think that what ends up happening is that someone like Frank Lampard, I agree with you, I think he should go abroad. I think he should go and, a coach in the, Spanish second division or, go to Belgium or something or whatever, and just go and coach, go and be a coach where, people aren't quite as interested, where you're not managing, Frank Lampard's Anderlecht, you're just managing Anderlecht. And there is a big difference between those two things. Nevertheless, when you achieve something, there's always going to be somebody that says, yeah, but Chelsea, do you remember what happened then? And there's always going to be this kind of cloud over a reputation.
Oh, yeah. Solskjaer at Cardiff, same thing. Yeah.
Solskjaer at Cardiff, exactly the same. You just wonder whether, I don't know how many goes round you have before the kind of bright young thing, it's going to be better in the future thing starts to, starts to change. You become reclassified as guy who belongs at mid-level club. It's a really difficult thing. I think it's an underappreciated part of a managerial career, because you have to balance your decisions so well, because it isn't just a meritocracy. Like, there's nothing can be further from the truth. You don't get what you deserve just by going to a going somewhere and winning things in an unfashionable league. You kind of, that can work against you too.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's why you get a lot of these dastardly foreigners who come into the Premier League in place of the English guys, but because they've proven that they can win things and meet real targets under difficult circumstances. And also, I mean, sure enough, Lampard's done the same coaching career path that many coaches will have done. But you look at like Brendan Rodgers. So Lampard's 42 now, and you're considered a young manager, I think, up until you're about 46, then you're not anymore. There's some sort of cut off. Brendan Rodgers is 48, still thought of as a young manager, but he was coaching.
People stopped looking up his age on Wikipedia. That's what it's a Jesse Lingard situation, just with managers.
Something like that. But then he's had like 20 years of coaching experience at all levels. Like, he's managed coaches, he's coached kids right through to that. Lampard will have done that for a couple of years, but he's had so much high level playing experience that you think it would learn him. But it's just not the same thing. Like, you might be the very best at writing novels, but it doesn't mean you can teach someone how to do it. It really is a different skill, and you can learn that skill by doing all your coaching courses and spending time doing it, but it's an entirely different discipline.
But it's like saying, oh, because you've read all of John Grisham's work, you could write a John Grisham book. It's the same principle, isn't it? You're just like, I spent a lot of time around the discipline in a way. But if you look at if you look at the coaching trees of, the obvious one, Alex Ferguson, how many really, really good coaches has he bred? Not very many. You know, it's not the same thing. Mourinho's kind of the same. Mourinho hasn't, I suppose the obvious one is Andre Villas-Boas. He's another one that fits into your guy who's won an awful lot, or did win an awful lot early in his career, but I still don't really know how good he is. Andre Villas-Boas. Andre Villas-Boas, I think it might have been Rory Smith on Twitter. He said he's run his managerial career along the lines of which parts of the world he wants to live in and what he wants to see. It's just like, so he's done London, Marseille, Porto, obviously, spent a bit of time in St. Petersburg. He's just crossed the continent to just experience different things. It's like because he has a slightly laissez-faire attitude towards his own career progression, it's as if, okay, fine. You kind of take him out of the equation and just let him get on with it. And now I think he's taking part in the World Rally Championship in somewhere. Just okay, fine.
Yeah, it's in Portugal, yeah. I love it.
Okay, we're running out of time, so we're going to cover some ground quite quickly. First up in France, where Lille are champions. If you want to know how and why, then drop in on Alex's video on the channel. And the TIFO YouTube channel will soon be supplemented by a second channel. JJ, would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I would love to. It's really exciting.
It's really exciting.
We just launched it today. We're recording this on a Monday, so Tuesday. I've ever listened to the podcast. It's called TIFO IRL. And it's just TIFO, but in real life, we're using internet acronyms because we are cool. And
and young.
really young and hip and super fresh. And we've got this tactics board built, and it's just, oh my God, like, I cannot tell you how much fun it is using it. So me and Alex have been doing these videos. We're going to do heaps during the Euros and everything, but we've got, you've seen, Alex one in Lille is superb, he's done. It's so detailed and all the tactics, how they've worked that. I did one on, I can't remember what my first one was, but I've got one on Trent Alexander-Arnold, which has just come out.
You did one on Arsenal and they're attacking Donut.
That's what I did. That was it. And then we're going to have like a Champions League preview and a Europa League preview coming out. It's just really exciting to have it, and the channel is up now and you can subscribe to it, and we'd love it if you did, because there's going to be loads of cool stuff.
There's going to be loads of cool stuff, particularly during the Euros. It's going to be a really, really exciting time. We hope you enjoy it. And the little thing was great. We talked about them quite a lot over the last few weeks. Want to highlight Jonathan David's performance, because he played really, really well against Angers on Sunday night, and he kind of provided the cutting edge that they didn't have the week before.
made a good run for the penalty, took his goal really nicely. Really, I don't know if you saw this, it was a really strange moment. So basically, this was coach Christophe Galtier's first league championship. He won a league cup about 10 years ago, but it's his first league success. And he's off to Nice, apparently. The Here We Go guy is reporting that. But it's really strange because this story seemed to leak over the weekend. So Lille played on... they played their decisive game at 9 o'clock European time on Sunday night. And this story was around from around Saturday lunchtime. It's like, why would you leak this, Nice? Like, you've got probably a one-off fixture that's going to be... I'll be very surprised, hopefully they do, but I'd be very surprised if Lille were able to repeat the success in the future. So you've got a coach who's leaving, and you've got a story out there about his leaving hours before a game like that. That's a terrible job from somebody.
But does it not just scream to you of sabotage?
Someone mischievous at PSG saying, yeah, you know what, he's off to... It's like do you remember the first series of Friday Night Lights, where they go to the national title game, and the night before when they're in the hotel in Dallas, there's a story that comes out because the coach is leaving them, and all these young players feel terribly betrayed, and there's a crisis, and you know will they play one more game for him? And it's very much that. And yeah, very, very strange one. In Italy, don't care about any of that because Juventus managed to get into the Champions League and ruin everything for everybody. Well done, Napoli, for not beating Verona. I hope you're proud of yourself. You just never get what you want in football, do you? Like, the thing that you, when the football universe works out that you've kind of cottoned on to a desire and you're kind of living vicariously through something, it just snatches it away. That's football. Like, if you're a fan of Real Madrid, probably not, but like for most of us, that's the existence, isn't it? Hope, no. That.
Yeah, and it drags you in. It's like one of those, what do you call them? What are the machines in a pub? A puggy. What do they call them? What do you call the buttons?
Fruit machine. Yeah.
There we go. This has been a tough Monday. But like, it's like a fruit machine, and then you keep trying again and again, but there's no real way to ever get what you truly want. Sometimes it'll give you it, and it'll make you think it'll do it again, but it won't.
If you just put in another pound coin, you know, or give it another season, or invest yourself a little bit more, then eventually you'll get something in return, and it'll make you feel happy. But it never, ever does. That is a really good moment to finish the podcast. And then a nice sort of cheerful ellipsis for a Monday morning. JJ, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. I think we can mention that Atletico Madrid won the league, but then we're done now.
Yeah, they did. And congratulations to them. There's a little bit of a hidden moment in that before we do go. So everyone will have seen it because this will only release on a Tuesday. So I'm sure lots of people will have covered this already. But if you watch the second Atletico goal, when Luis Suarez is running in, if you watch it from the angle behind the goal and keep your eyes on Marcus Llorente, because he does that thing where one of your teammates runs through on goal and he's got like 50 yards to go and you think, I'm not going to catch him, so I'm just going to stand here and shout encouragement. He does that. It's great. You can see him going, go on, Luis, go on. So have a look out for that. And we will talk to you again on Friday.
The Athletic.